This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before there was a gay rights movement, there was the Daughters of Bilitis. It was the first national lesbian group in the country. My guests Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon co-founded it in 1955. They're now considered mothers of the gay rights movement. The Daughters of Bilitis was created as an alternative to the gay bar scene, but developed into an activist group with the mission of helping lesbians discover their potential and find their place in society. Martin is now 71, Lyon is 68. They've been a couple for 39 years. The group disbanded in the 70s, but Martin and Lyon have remained outspoken advocates of gay rights. 20 years ago, they collaborated on the book Lesbian Woman. A new anniversary edition was recently published. I asked them if they knew there was such a thing as a lesbian when they started having feelings toward women.
No.
No.
Sexuality was not talked about in those days, and let alone homosexuality.
Yeah, we're talking way back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and I didn't really find out about lesbians until I met Del, actually.
And what year was that?
That was in
1949,
right. And I knew vaguely that there were such things as male homosexuals, but that was about it. But when I look back, I know that I was always fascinated with women. I just didn't have a clue as to what to do about that.
Del, what about you? What was the first time that you had a sense that you felt things toward other women?
Oh, when I was about 10 or 12, and I figured that I was different, and I was the only one.
The only one in the world?
The only one in the world. That's a story we hear over and over again in our age group. Everybody thought, oh, I'm the only one.
Well, you got married when you were 19. Did you?
Right.
Did you do that in spite of thinking that you were different?
Well, at that particular time, there was no woman that I was particularly attracted to, so I thought maybe that was over with.
Where did you each find out more about other lesbians, about the fact that you weren't alone? Did you turn to books? Did you turn to other people?
Well, there really weren't any books, except, you know, unless you went to the first you had to know the word homosexual or lesbian in order to look anything up.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was nothing that was any good in the libraries in those early days.
And mostly it just told you how sick you were.
So it frightened you when you found the books, actually.
Right. There's no way that we could identify with that. I think the first book that I read that helped me out was Radcliffe Hall's book.
The Well of Loneliness, yeah.
You both read that?
No, I didn't. Somehow or other I missed that, so that I was still, I mean, I was through college and working before I found out about lesbians, and that was only because, it was about 1949, that Del and I and another woman we worked with were having drinks at the press club in Seattle after work, and somehow or other the subject came up, and Del said she was a lesbian, and I was fascinated, because I'd never met one before, I thought. The first thing I did when I got home was call everybody I knew and tell them.
Tell them about Del?
Yeah. I didn't know that was a bad thing. Fortunately, it had no repercussions to speak of.
Yeah, talk about outing.
Talk about naivete.
So, Phyllis, did you get the feeling right away that, well, you know, maybe you were too? Did that strike you?
Not right at the moment. We had already become pretty close friends, Del and I, and then, of course, I was curious. But one of the things I had discerned about myself was that in my relationships with men, what I was doing was, in essence, sort of chasing after the ones I was interested in. And then when I caught them, as it were, then I became disinterested. And I was kind of afraid that the same thing would happen if I chased after Del. So I didn't do anything for quite a while, as a matter of fact.
Then she was going to leave town and...
For good.
And so it was then or never.
Who made the first move?
I did, but as Phyllis says, I made a pass and she completed it.
She sort of made a half pass.
How did you both meet?
On the job. We were working for trade publications in Seattle.
And you knew each other from working together?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Well, I was working in Seattle before, and then the boss told us all that he had this gay divorcee coming from San Francisco.
He didn't know how gay.
And so, I was fascinated because I had lived in San Francisco. I went to UC Berkeley, and I had lived partially in San Francisco, and it was great to know somebody from down there was coming up.
Del, you had already been married. What happened to end the marriage?
I fell in love with a woman next door, and my feelings were really awakened by then, and I just felt I needed to do something about it.
When you started being a couple, a lot of lesbian relationships were in the kind of butch femme mode. Was your relationship that way too early on?
Well, it was sort of, yeah. I think that it didn't really stay that way very long, although to all intents and purposes, we were still a butch femme couple in public. Since Della decided, when I met her, I decided she was a butch, I didn't have much of an option. So I became a femme. I've often thought I would have made a really good butch. And besides which, I did all of the butch kind of things, if you will. I mean, I drive, and Del doesn't, and I can drive a nail in, and she can't, and, you know, stuff like that. But we conformed to what the going thing was outside the home, but not certainly didn't do it when we were at home.
Yeah, I was a sissy butch.
Yeah.
So there was pressure on you. You felt that, like, I mean, from what you knew about lesbian couples, this is the way it had to be. This is the way it was supposed to be. Butch and femme.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's how everybody was doing. Because at that point in time, the only model anybody had was mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody was kind of following that.
Yeah, and when we first got together, I had a job that I had lined up before I came back to San Francisco from Seattle, and Phyllis would get up and make me breakfast, which I didn't like to eat in those days. That didn't last very long.
That's what my mother had always done, right? She had always gotten up and gotten Dad's breakfast. So I thought, well, this is what you have to do. But as Del said, it didn't last very long.
When did you give it up?
I didn't like doing it either.
When did you give it up?
Oh, probably within a month.
Oh, that quickly?
So. Oh, I think so.
Oh, yeah, at least. Yeah,
that might have been sooner.
Well, how did you bring it up with each other that you're going to change and that you weren't going to conform to that standard anymore?
I don't think we really talked about it. We just sort of acted like ourselves.
Phyllis, how do you think the relationship was changed when you decided to give up those roles?
Well, I think what happened was that we just became the people that we had when we became friends. We didn't really deal with those kinds of roles because I was supposedly Del's straight friend anyway. So we were on a different kind of footing. Then when we became lovers, there was this sudden switch from, you know, masculine, feminine. She was supposed to be the aggressor and all these kinds of things. And I think then we just wandered back to being the people that we actually were, which was neither the aggressor nor the non-aggressor, if you will.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon. Their 1972 book, Lesbian Woman, has just been published in a new edition. And they're the founders of the group Daughters of Bilitis, which is the first national lesbian organization. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon are my guests. You met in 1949. In 1955, you co-founded Daughters of Bilitis. Why did you feel you wanted to start some kind of organization, and what did you have in mind when you started it? What did you want it to be? What did you need it to be?
Well, it wasn't our idea, But we had met a lesbian through a couple of gay men that lived around the corner from us. And she called us one morning, Saturday morning, and said, how would you like to join with us in a social club for lesbians? And we were just delighted because we didn't know any, and we were so starved for socializing with other lesbians that we jumped at the chance. What Daughters of Bleeda started out to be was a very secret lesbian social club.
Where did the name come from, Daughters of Bleeda?
From the Songs of Bleeda by Pierre Louis, which is a long lesbian narrative poem.
It's a poem you knew?
The lesbian who invited us to join the club had read the book, and she offered that as a suggestion for the name of it.
She thought that lesbians would know what Bleeda's meant, but nobody else would. I don't think that was true, because I don't think most lesbians knew about the Songs of Bleeda. However, it worked out as a name.
It was supposed to be a secret, and we have spent many, many years now trying to explain the name.
So I guess it worked pretty well. You know, some people, when they hear the name, think it sounds like a disease, Bleeda's.
Well, that's why we pronounced it Bleeda's.
Instead of Bleeda's, like phlebitis?
Instead of Bleeda's, because we didn't want it to sound like a disease. And that was at the time, you know, when Eisenhower had ileitis. And so we said, no, it's got to be Bleeda's, so it doesn't sound like an illness.
So you were trying to keep the organization, you know, very, very secret to protect the members. Were there ways that lesbians could let other lesbians know who they were, like little cues lesbians could give each other through the way they dressed or wore their hair or whatever?
Well, I think that's probably why so many lesbians dress pretty butchy, to let others know that here's a possibility.
Did you go to the bars at all before or after you co-founded Daughters of Bleeda?
Oh, yeah.
What was the bar scene like then?
Well, what was it like? It was, for many lesbians, it was the only outlet. It was the only place they had to go where they could be themselves. It was the only place they knew to go to meet other lesbians, for sure, you know, without being, you know, perhaps making a costly mistake. And it's true there was a lot of drinking, and which is what goes on in bars. But it was the only place. It was the only...
And it was a risky place.
Yeah.
Because periodically there would be police raids. And one of the things that we worked through on that one was during the Daughters of Bleeda, when we started to have public...
Discussion meetings.
And we got attorneys to come and talk to us and tell us our rights. And what we found when a bar raid took place, that most everybody pleaded guilty and a plea of disturbing the peace or visiting a house of ill repute or whatever to get out of it and pay a fine. But in actuality, what they were pleading guilty to was being gay, because they hadn't done anything that was illegal in these places. They were just there. So when we found an attorney who said, just plead nulla contendere, so you were there. And then when the police officer was asked, you know, what we did in the bars, all I could say was they just rounded us all up, and there was nothing that the court could do but let us go. When I say us, I'm talking about lesbians in general. Phyllis and I never got caught up in a raid. We missed one by a day, another by a week, but we didn't get caught up. But we did find legal help for those who did.
When you started Daughters of Bilitis, there was a gay men's counterpart at the time, the Mattachine Society. How did the two groups get along?
Well, the Mattachine Society was primarily gay males, and it was open to women, you know, to lesbians, and but they had very few, and it was so male oriented. However, they were helpful to us. At one point, they let us share an office, a very tiny one. until we could get, ourselves in gear and find our own quarters.
What were the issues that you felt the two groups had in common and the issues in which you diverted from each other?
Well, I think basically what we had in common was the fact that we were both homosexual and therefore we were illegal, immoral, and sick. Other than that, the lesbians' concerns were more on civil concerns, not so much criminal concerns, whereas gay men were always getting into difficulties around public restrooms and cruising in public places and so on. Lesbians were more concerned about bringing up their children, if they had children, about how to keep their household together, how to buy a house together, if that was possible, and things like that. It was typical differences between men and women, really.
Mm-hmm.
And Mattachine was going before Daughters of Bilitis, but we didn't know about it until after DOB got started. But the men were very chauvinistic, for the most part.
How so?
They were men.
Yeah. Right.
Anybody who thinks that gay men are not masculine in the sense of being very righteous and it's their baby, forget it. As far as the lesbians were concerned, they could join, they could be receptionists or typists, but never really a part of it.
But this was before feminism, so I mean, not only
not only
was gay rights in its very formative stages, there really wasn't a strong women's rights movement at the time either, so you didn't have a word feminism to describe your feelings of the men being chauvinistic. So did you have a context to put that in?
Well, no, we didn't know that much about feminism, but we did write articles about discrimination against women in the early days.
Mm-hmm. Certainly lesbians were aware that they needed to work because nobody was going to come along and support them. And and we were also aware that we didn't get paid the same money that men did. We didn't quite know what we could do about that.
But as a matter of fact, in the jobs where we met, we received titles rather than raises.
Yeah.
Let me jump ahead a little bit. You were active in the formation of the gay rights movement in the late 60s and early 70s when the gay rights movement really expanded. Were there things that you felt really involved with and then issues that you felt kind of left out of for generational reasons? You know what I mean? Because you'd come of age during a more repressive era.
Mm-hmm. Well, but we had never left, Terry. I mean, we had never quit being involved with the movement, and we had also become involved with the women's movement.
Mm-hmm.
As soon
mm-hmm.
as NOW got started, we got involved with NOW. And so on. So I don't know that we ever felt as if we were left out. I think that when Lesbian Woman came out in 1972, we thought that maybe we would have problems when we went around to university campuses and so on to talk about it, that they might think we were a couple of old fuddy-duddies and trash us, as it were. But that didn't happen because we found that no matter how radical people were becoming and so on, they still had these basic questions and basic problems like, how do you tell your parents that you're gay? And what do you do about coming out in school and so on?
What are the issues that you're active in now?
Well, we're now with the Gay and Lesbian Outreach to Elders. I'm 71.
And I was just 68 a while ago. And Yeah, so we're very interested in the militant movement of old lesbians, which is very militant and very active. That's lesbian 60 and up. And we're still involved with feminist issues, and we've been very much involved in politics, and we're just elated at what has happened in this election, that we have elected so many pro-choice and pro-gay rights people, like our two women from California, Senator Dianne Feinstein and Senator-elect Barbara Boxer.
Well, and the thing, we're getting pretty much involved with the whole issue of ageism through the old lesbians. And as we have said, we've had to invent our lives as we've gone along, and now we're inventing our lives as old lesbians.
As aging lesbians now, you said you're working on ageism as an issue. What are some of the things that you're facing now socially in America that are new for you as you age?
Well, I think it's sort of the same things that are happening to all old people, that one becomes invisible if one has gray hair very often. People tend to talk to the younger people that are with you instead of to you as if you were some kind of an idiot person. It's just...
Well, the assumption that we're all old and decrepit.
Right.
And, you know, those who really took care of their bodies and exercised are still in very good shape.
Did you?
No.
No.
But we're in good shape anyway. Exercise has not been something we have indulged in over the years.
Well, I wish you good health and good luck, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Dil Martin and Phyllis Lyon co-founded the Daughters of Bilitis. There's a new 20th anniversary edition of their book, Lesbian Woman, published by Volcano Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.